tonight is March 2nd, and this is, I believe, the 14th in the series. Okay, we hope to speak about it. We're talking about Amsterdam. So Amsterdam was a very, very unique situation for the Jews. It became a tremendous haven for the Jews, first for Muranos, and it became a very, very, it was a large, relatively large Murano community where Muranos were able to come back to Judaism. Not too many places were they able to come back. Outside of Islam, outside of the Muslim world, not too many places were they able to come back to become Jews. And Amsterdam became a haven for them. Also then, it also became a haven for Ashkenazim. First for the Jews in Germany during the 30 Years' War, and then later, after which ended in 1648, and then after 1648 for the Jews in Poland that went through the Chmielnytskyi's massacres, the Gzeres Tachvatat, many of them ended up into should we move the garbage can there to open it? Okay. Well, this is the front gate with the car or
the car gate, and he finally showed up.
Yeah. All right. I mean, he should know. I mean, like, okay, so yeah. Okay. So first, and then for the Ashkenazim, after the 30 Years' War, and then Tachvatat, and then after Poland. So it became, eventually, the Ashkenazim became a larger community than the Sephardim, even though the Sephardim were mostly very wealthy. And, so it was a unique type of a place. As a matter of fact, it was actually called the place, the Makom, That was Amsterdam. But I figured before we do that, before we get into how the Jews got there and how it was very, very kind, it was a good place, it was a nice place for the Jews, just a little bit into the history of Amsterdam. So originally it was called the Netherlands, and really it was like divided into two parts. It was the northern place, or the northern part, which is where Amsterdam is going to be, and then the lower part of the Netherlands, which is really today Belgium. So basically, there's going to be a rebellion, and the Netherlands really were part of the Spanish holdings. So whoever owned Spain owned the Netherlands. That's basically how it was. And because originally, when Spain became
the Netherlands were together.
Correct. At some point, it was really a conglomerate of different city-states.
What year is this?
So all the way until the 1600s. All the way until the 1500s, really. A lot's going to happen, and it's going to become... Well, we'll see. But, okay, so like in the 13th century and the 1200s, it was part of the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire was really parts of France, all the way, the entire European continent, including the Netherlands and France, all the way to Austria on the other side. That was all one, all the way into Italy. That was all part of the Holy Roman Empire. And then after Charlemagne, after his son, they divided up into three parts, and then one part became France, and one part became Lothar, in the middle became different areas, and then Germany became one part. So that's, and it just, the history evolved in the next few hundred years. So it became part of the Holy Roman Empire. The south of it was, a place called Flanders, which is, that's where Belgium would be now. And the north became windmills and dikes and tulips, yeah. Okay, now let's just moving on to where it really is Nogaya in 1477. Okay, in 1477, now keep in mind, in 1492 is going to be when the Jews are going to be kicked out of Spain. Okay? For the last 100 years of Spain, things are not going well for the Jews. In 1391, there was a in Spain there was riots, and the bands riots went from town to town, and that's mainly when you had tens of thousands, if not 100,000 Jews converted, you know. So in 1391, and then for 1391 to 1492, the Jews were, whatever Jews remained, they were really a shadow of itself, and it was, they were on the defense. And finally in 1492, they just got rid of the Jews. But in 1477, now you got to follow all this. See, this is Yichus, this is Yevamos, okay? So now, you're starting off with the Duke of Burgundy, and he's the one who is the holding of the Netherlands. He had a daughter named Mary. Okay, Mary marries Maximilian of the Habsburgs. Now, Maximilian is the heir to the Holy Roman Empire. In other words, I'm not sure if it was, I think it was his father who was the Holy Roman Emperor, and Maximilian is going, it was his son. So he, Maximilian, marries Mary. Mary is the daughter of the Duke of Burgundy's, who is the ruler of the Netherlands. Okay? So they get together, and they have a child named Philip. Okay? Now, basically, what the Habsburgs do to the Netherlands is they basically use the Netherlands for their taxes. They steal the money from the Netherlands to help them with their war against France. Okay? So that's like, you know, that's okay. So the nobles revolt. They don't like this, but the businessmen, they like the stability of the Roman Empire. They like big, you know, big empires, stability. So rather than just revolt and go on it on our own, and you have to worry about the big players of Germany and France, so we'll be part of Germany. All right, so we'll pay a little few extra dollars. I guess they could have afforded it. Okay, the revolt fails. Next, now what happens is, they have a son, Philip, okay? So Maximilian, who is going to be the emperor, eventually we'll see, he's going to be the Holy Roman Emperor, and his wife, Mary, is the heir to the Netherlands, okay? They have a son, Philip. And Philip marries in 1496. Now, again, the Jews were kicked out in 1492. So they got kicked out of Spain, they were kicked out of the Netherlands. So that's it. If there were Jews there before, they're not there anymore. Okay, so in 1496, their daughter Juana La Loca, Loca means what, crazy?
Crazy.
So a few years after she married Philip, she went crazy. Yeah, we went through this. We went through all the kids of Ferdinand and Isabel, and it was like it was like the Kennedys, you know, they just, you know, crazy things happened to all of them, you know. So, but in any case, she married Philip. So now you have to realize Philip from, and they had a son by the name of Charles. Okay, so now you have Charles, whose mother was Juana, or what's her name again? Juana, I don't know how they call it. Juana, who is a daughter of Ferdinand and Isabel from Spain, okay? And then you have his father, Philip, gets from the, so Charles gets from his Zadie, he gets the Holy Roman Empire, right? All of Germany. And from his mother, he gets the Netherlands. And from his, that's from his father's side, right? And from his mother's side, he has Spain. Okay, so now you're going to all coming down into a person by the name of Charles. Now, in Spain, he was Charles the First. And in Germany, he's going to be known as Charles the Fifth. I guess there were five Charles before him. Okay. So now, son of Juan, after the, now, 1504, Ferdinand dies. Okay. And then King Philip, who's Charles' father, becomes the king of Spain. Okay. Now, Maximilian is, his father-in-law is still the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which Philip would get the Holy Roman Empire if Maximilian passes away. But Philip dies after 2 years, okay? So now Philip in 1506, Philip dies. And now Charles becomes Charles the First of Castile, and I guess Castile and Aragon, and and he becomes, and he is now also the Duke of Burgundy, which is the Netherlands. And okay, so now he's got the Netherlands and Castile, and then in 1519, Maximilian dies. And Charles V now is the Holy Roman Emperor as well. So
same
he
guy.
Has, I'm sorry?
Same guy we're talking about.
Same guy, same Charles, right? So now everybody finally dies and he gets it all. He's okay. So now he's also got very busy, Hungary, okay. So he's now got, he's got a lot. He's the King of Spain. He also owns, he has Sicily, Naples, Sardinia, which is all parts around Italy. He has much of South Africa and much of North America. I'm sorry, not, much of South America and much of North America, because you have to realize Spain is heavily into the Americas. You know, they own a lot of holdings in America, and he is became the king of Spain. He spent his time, you know, I think mostly in Spain, but he, like once or twice a year, he would come to Germany. I mean, they'd have that diet in Germany with him there. But basically, he was going back and forth between Spain and Germany. Okay, this is what he looked like. This is one picture of what it looked like. The light yellow is the Holy Roman Empire. The orange is the Netherlands. This is what do you have? Sardinia and Sicily. You also these are the forgot what these are called. The Majorca, Minorca, whatever. So he also has Spain. Okay, this is Castile and this is Aragon. He gets them both, I guess, after his father passes away, he gets Aragon too, his father-in-law. I'm not sure if his father-in-law dies in 1506, but by 1519 he had everything. So we're talking about Charles, who inherited a lot from his mother. He got Spain and all these holdings, including from his mother. From his father, he got the Holy Roman Empire, and from his father's mother, he got the Netherlands. And this is all under one person. If you want to just look at it this way. Okay, so anything that's orange is what he inherited. So Charles inherited Castile and Aragon of Spain. He also had, I guess as the Holy Roman Emperor, he owned these lands, these orange lands. Yellow means he conquered. So these lands he ended up getting afterwards. And as you can see, North America and South America he had as well. Green is friendly. So he had treaties with Portugal and different areas. England, he was okay with. His enemies, you see, mainly his two main enemies were France and the Turks. Just very inconvenient when you're surrounded both sides from them. And Brandenburg, okay, he had his hands full, basically.
What was his language?
I think he spoke, I think it was his Spanish, because he grew up in the Spanish Netherlands. He probably was multilinguistic, but I think
a lot of different languages.
He must have. He definitely must have. Basically, what he did is he also had his brother, Ferdinand, his brother was the regent. He was acting. His brother Ferdinand was acting as the Holy Roman Emperor when he was away in Spain, which was much of the time. And Ferdinand was very nicely disposed to the Jews. We mentioned earlier in the year, Rav Yoselman of Rosheim. Okay, so I just want to see if it's over here. But okay, so he's also, I'll just go back to here for a sec, just a few things about Charles. So. In we mentioned when we spoke about Rav Yoselman of Rosheim, so he was the representative of the Jews in Germany. So Ferdinand was very well disposed to him. He had a very good relationship with Ferdinand and also Charles when he came. So it was Charles and Ferdinand. However, it was very hard for Charles, you have to realize, is because in Spain they had thrown all their Jews out. So Spain and the Spanish Netherlands, it was usher for there to be a Jew there at all. Yet he also was the emperor of Germany, where they did not have such a rule on the books. There were Jews in Germany. So he had to balance in his Holy Roman Empire, there were Jews there. And the Jews were not thrown out. There was not usher for there to be Jews, as opposed to in Spain and the Netherlands. Even though there was a lot of pressure on Charles to do in Germany what was already in Spain and the Netherlands. So it really, you know, the Jews at that point, it could have gone a different way. You know, I guess Charles had the foresight enough to realize if he's going to do that in Germany, he may lose Germany. As a matter of fact, because he also had another issue, and that was Lutheranism. Luther, this is around the time, this is when Luther became big and Protestant. So Charles always had to, it was only, you know, thinking of it, looking at it this way, again, I don't know if this is entirely accurate, but because of Luther, it could have very well been that the Jews were not kicked out of Germany. Because as a Holy Roman Emperor, you need all your nobles there, especially your seven electorates. In Germany, that were responsible. They were above all of the other nobles. Again, there were about 300 some odd different counties and city states in Germany at the time, and he needed the support of them all, right? And if he's going to start with now, some of the nobles in Germany sided with Luther, and if he's going to make Protestant and Catholicism the big issue, he may lose the nobles and they may give him a hard time, especially at a time when he was at war with the Turks, with the Ottomans and France. So he it wasn't like there weren't any other wars going on. So he had to somehow keep the peace with the nobles. So because of that, he didn't want to push the religion part in Germany. He always was staying back from it. But that was in Germany. He had no problems to impose the Inquisition in the Netherlands. So in the Netherlands, yeah, okay. And he backs up, sure. What was good for Spain could be good for the Netherlands, especially it was, you know, sort of connected with Spain. Okay, so this is all Charles. I'm sorry.
So at this point in time in the Netherlands, it's not
no
really
Jews.
The Jews at all.
There's no Jews. No Jews. And if there were, Muranos or Conversos, they were there, okay. Probably, but they had to be careful, like they had to be careful in Spain.
Okay.
Okay. And he actually, you know, brings in the Inquisition into the Netherlands and tries, you know. Okay, so. Everything. Now, the only difference is between the Netherlands. Just one more thing. Something else. But where is the? Okay. Well, the difference between though the Netherlands and Spain is that Netherlands borders on Germany. So what was happening in Germany was the Netherlands were very affected by it. And the Lutheran and his Reformation is going to affect in a very direct way the Netherlands. As a matter of fact, they're going to be taken in by Calvinism, John Calvin, which was an offshoot of Lutheranism, is a different type, is going to be very influential in the Netherlands to such a point that there's going to be a revolt. Something is going to give. But that's not going to be for just a little bit. Okay, so that's what we have now. So we're now in the 1500s, the mid 1500s, 1520, 1530, and just an idea of what the economy in even this is before Jews are there. Dutch plays is wildly economic. I guess it was a free market there. It wasn't, you know, very restrictive. And it says that they were very into shipping, as you could see. Amsterdam is right off of the English Channel, you know. It hasn't changed, right? So, but just to your point, by the 1580s, okay, and there were not really Jews there yet. But in 1580, Holland had 1,800 seagoing ships. just compare it with Venice, that only had about 300. Okay, so it is doing a lot more, you know, things with the you know, business over the sea. Now, this is all before the West Dutch's India Company and the East Dutch's India Company, which is going to, you know, which is going to really explode. It's going to take this small country of Amsterdam, Dutch, or whatever, Holland, whatever you call the country, and it's going to be competing with, like, these big major countries. And no short, you know, there's no small part are the Jews going to play of all this, but I'm getting ahead of myself. But the Jews aren't even here yet. Okay. Now, again, what was happening in 1549 to 1566. So, first of all, in 1549, you now have, in 1555, 1556, Charles abdicates the throne. Because he goes into retirement, he wants to play golf the rest of his life. He's not interested in this whole thing. And he goes ahead and he gives Germany to his brother Ferdinand, and he gives Spain and the Netherlands to his son Philip. Okay? That's how he divides pretty much it. So now the Spanish Netherlands are under Philip. Philip, who has now, he doesn't have Germany as his issue, now he's more into holding the line of Christianity. So now when Calvinism, now when you have Protestants are coming into the Netherlands, he's going to respond very strongly against them, which is going to lead to a revolt, which is going to lead for the northern part of Netherlands breaking away from Spain. Hence, you're going to have an area in Europe, the northern Netherlands, which is going to be a place which is going to be a very... an area where the Jews are going to be able to go. That's basically the short of it. If I had to say it any shorter, that's pretty much it. This is all happening in 1549 to 1566. In 1556, again, Germany, after Charles, he gave it to Ferdinand. Jews were allowed to stay in Germany the whole time. Rav Yosselman, during this time, this is when he was an advocate for the German people. And he abdicates the throne of Spain and Spanish Netherlands to his son Philip. Okay, so now we have a new system here, 1556. Germany is now under Ferdinand, and that's one country, and Spain is under Philip and Philip II, and that's another country. Philip now introduces the Inquisition to the Netherlands to stop this Reformation going on. He also suspends semi-autonomous privileges to the provinces. In others, basically, he wants a stronger hand in things. And he doesn't like the way things are going there. He wants more. He wants to be more in control of the Netherlands. Leads to open rebellion. He then takes somebody called the Duke of Alba. I forgot his name. But he instituted something called the Council of Trouble, also known as the Council of Blood. It seems that this Council of Blood went in there, and anybody that was a dissenter, anybody that was following Protestantism, whether it's Lutheranism or Calvinism, were killed. 1567, that's his name, Alvarez de Toledo, third Duke of Alba. So he went in by the orders of Philip to punish ringleaders and recent political trouble. Yeah, 18,000. It became known as the Council of Blood. So basically what happened is the South, which was Brussels and Antwerp in the South, ended up staying with Spain. And that's why even today, Belgium, which is today Belgium, comes across as a Catholic country, as opposed to Holland, Denmark, and the countries north of that. Those are countries which are not, they're Protestant countries, or they come across. So in 1974, there was the States General of the Netherlands his successor, this Fernando's successor, Luis de... I have no idea how to say that name, Rick, or whatever. He ended up, you know, they realized they stopped this Inquisition, this Council of Blood. And, so there was a person by the name of William of Orange in 1575, and he led a rebellion against Philip II with a whole bunch of different, like, areas. One was called Holland, Zeeland, Utrecht. These are different, like, areas, cities, or provinces, and all against Philip II, and it held out. and that was the beginning of it. They had religious tolerance in the university. Also, during that time, there was the collapse of Spanish finances. I guess it took a few hundred years. It took, 1492? It took about 80 years without an Abarbanel, and Spain went broke. How is it? I mean, they had so much money coming in. I guess it was probably a lot of inflation, because when you're having tons of gold and silver from the New World coming in, and you're not, you know, I wouldn't even know what to do, how to keep the economy afloat, you know, with such a thing. But it fell apart. Also, they also had the Spanish Fury by mutineers. They would come into I believe Spanish soldiers. They would come in to the ports of the Netherlands, and they would like burn down boats, and then come into the city and sack the cities. So there was one big one, which was in Antwerp in 1576. Okay, but this is what was happening during that time. And finally, in like 1589 or the 1580s, they finally declared their independence. So I believe it was like 1586. Let's see if it's on the next one. Okay, in 1581, William the Silent, or William the of Orange, is assassinated. His son keeps up with it. And then, okay, so while this was happening, again, these northern places were fighting against Spain to not to be taken over. Spain was bringing in their troops, and the battle was more in the north as opposed to the south, maybe the south also, but they were going to end up controlling the south but not the north. In order to, this is again historical, how, you know, in order to help the North fight the Spanish, so England, Queen Elizabeth, said, hey, you know what, maybe we can send some troops in to help William of Orange, actually his son, who is his Mauritius, to help them fight off the Spain. And he does. And she does. She sends troops in, you know, soldiers in to help them fight off the Spanish. Well, Spain doesn't like this. So in 1588, what does Spain do? They sent the Spanish Armada, 130 ships, to go ahead to get England. And they really blew it. I mean, they came to England, they were expecting more ships, and what ended up happening is had they attacked England when they first got there, England was not prepared. They could have really done a lot of damage, but they didn't. They waited for other ships, and basically they were taken out by a few small British ships that they were just harassing them, and eventually what happened is you know, they had the big Spanish, you know, fighting ships, which were protecting all of the other ships in the middle. And basically what they did, the way they broke the formation, is one night, in the middle of the night, they took about five ships, or maybe 5 to 10 ships, they put them on fire, and they sent them to the middle of the, they sent them into the middle of the Spanish Armada. And that the last thing you need is a burning ship going on your ship. So basically the Spanish, they all broke formation. They all broke in the middle of the night. Everybody went different places, and then they were all vulnerable, and they were attacked by the British. It was like one section of the Spanish, you know, where the big ships were on one end. They kept formation, but basically it was a defeat for the Spanish Armada. And since the 1588 on, England then became the, I guess, king of the sea, so to speak. And this is all starting with Elizabeth. I'm sure there were other things involved as well, but this had some part to do with it, by the fact that England got involved in the Netherlands. They sent the Spanish Armada. England won that battle, and also bad luck. They went around and they got stuck into probably a hurricane, a big storm, and the Spanish Armada was basically wiped out. And now England is now the new naval power. Only second, if I'm correct, the second biggest navy in the world would be Holland, would be the Dutch, because of all their ships. Okay, in 1609, there's going to be a 12-year truce. All right, so where do the Jews come in? Okay, in 1597, the Spanish were driven out of the seven provinces. This is going to be the big, this is the, that make up the Netherlands. The south place, including Belgium, remained Catholic. In the next 80 years, there was intermittent fighting until 1648. 1648 was a big year because it was the, it ended the 30-year war, and there was the Treaty of Westphalia. And in that Treaty of Westphalia, they did a lot of things. It ended the 30-year war. It also ended, it also included the Netherlands. So it was official that Spain recognized the independence of the Netherlands. Okay, that's 1648. So really, already from the 1560s, 80 years earlier, Spain was really out already, but they just kept attacking to try to get it back. That's for the next 80 years. And probably as the time went on, it was less and less until 1648. Spain finally recognized, okay, the Netherlands, the northern part at least, that it's free. Okay. Brilliant General Mauritius, he could, that is the same one who took over for his father. They had new engineering, they had lots of trade. I think it was the navy, here it is, it was a very, very advanced navy. They were cutting edge, you know, they kept their army with the latest weapons and latest strategies and boats. Okay. Okay, Spain gets involved. Also, Spain gets involved in 1590. They have their other wars that they have to deal with. Once they get into involved with other wars, so this the Dutch War, the Dutch, they got a pass, so to speak. Okay, 1590, 1609, rich trades in Asia, Africa, and America. This is called there were two major companies, probably the first international companies that were selling stocks in the world, was the East Dutch India Company and the West Dutch India Company. The East Dutch India Company is going to do business in mainly Indonesia, in where Vietnam is, in Japan. That's the East. And in the West, it's going to be there. In the West is going to be in the Americas, and they're going to be playing against Portugal, Spain, and England, and they're going to be holding their own. Again, they don't have the major resources in terms of people and everything like the other countries, but they have the financial resources. And we'll see how they're very smart. They did things in a brilliant way. It's also going to be responsible for Jews going to America, because they're going to be working for the West India, Dutch West India Company, right? So they're going to be working. They're going to start settling there, and that's going to be the beginning of Jews in America. Okay. Now let's go to the Jews. How did the Jews get there? Okay, so that's pretty much now. In the 1580s, there was already this rebellion, and basically they were independent of Spain. It just wasn't official until for another 50-some-odd years. But in 1593, the story goes that there was a ship that left Portugal, and on the ship there was a brother and a sister, Manuel Lopez Pereiro, and his sister, Maria Nunez. And there, I'm not sure where they were setting to go, but the ship was captured by England. At the time, again, this is 1593, 1588 was where the Spanish Armada was taken out. So Portugal and Spain against England. So England found themselves a boat, and they brought it into England. When they got into England, there was this nobleman that was captured by this Maria Nunez. And he said to her, "I want to marry you." Now, these were Muranos, right? They weren't, you know, Maria and her brother Manuel were Muranos. So they looked like Spanish. They looked like, you know, Christians, and they acted like Christians. The nobleman sees this Nunez, this Maria, and he says he wants to marry her. So somehow it made its way to Queen Elizabeth. And Queen Elizabeth says, "Who is this? What? This nobleman sees a girl and he wants to marry her from Spain? Let me see this girl." So he sees this girl, and she's also captivated by the girl. And it seems that she spent the entire day in a carriage, you know, driving around England, you know, with this Maria Nunez. In any case, at the end of the day, she was offered to marry this nobleman. She would have lived the rest of her life in luxury, and she refused. But because of this, the queen let the boat go. So even though they were in England, they let the boat go, and the boat ends up in Amsterdam. Okay? And the boat comes to Amsterdam. So they in 1598, they were joined by the rest of their relatives. She married a guy named Marano, another Marano. I don't know his name. It seems that this was the first Jewish wedding in Amsterdam. Now, I guess when they got there, I don't know if they were still acting as Maranos or they started to become Jews, at least on the outside. And it says that there were 24 cousins from both the Chassan and the Kala side, which is a big thing. It seems to be the first wedding in Amsterdam. A few years after that.
The first public wedding.
Public wedding, right. Public, I should say. Right. So and now, a few years after that, another group got out. And this is a group of Maranos. They left Portugal and they went to the German port of Emden. So they're in Emden, they get off the boat, and these Maranos, there's a whole group of them, they're walking down the streets and they see a house that has Hebrew letters on it in Germany, Emden. They said, "This looks like Hebrew." You gotta realize this is, you know, these are Maranos, you know. 1496 is when they had, you know, when this whole thing happened. It's 100 years ago. They may never have seen Hebrew. So, or they, whatever, they saw Hebrew, and they were right, it was Hebrew, and they knocked on the door. And this person was the name of Moshe Uriel Levy. And they said to him, "All right, hook us up. Now we want to become Jews." So Moshe Uriel Levy said to him, he says, "Look, you know, I can't do it. It's too dangerous. You were baptized. And the halacha is in the Christians, if you are Christian, once you're a Christian, you're always a Christian. And if you go back to be Jews, you're a heretic, and they kill you, they'll kill me, and that's not a good thing. But I'll tell you what I'll do." And this is what he tells him. He says, "Go to Amsterdam. If you go to Amsterdam, I'll follow you there, and then I'll teach you whatever you have to know." And that's what happened. And he followed them there. This Moshe Uriel Levy followed them there, and he had started a community with 10 adult males and 4 children, and it was started in the home of the Moroccan envoy Shmuel Palasha, if I'm spelling his name correctly. Shmuel Palasha, I guess, was a practicing Jew, and he was able to be there, and he looked because he was an ambassador from the North Africa country, and because of that, he was looking and practicing Jew, and therefore, you know, they had services in his home. So this Moshe Uriel Levy circumcised them and started teaching them Torah, and probably this other group also. They all started getting together, and now at the time Amsterdam was under the Dutch Reformed Church. Now, on the books they were like freedom of religion. But that didn't apply to the Christians, because the Christians all over were killing Calvinists all over. So they said, "Well, here we're in a Calvinist country. We're not going to allow the Christians to do Christian, you know, the Catholics to be Catholics. You know, if they're killing us there, then well, we're going to kill them here." So if you were a practicing Catholic, that's it. They would stop you, kill you, throw you in jail, or throw you out. So what happened is here you had this community, these Jews, and probably on Yom Kippur, they had probably more people coming, and, you know, there was a nice amount of people. So the authorities came in, you know, with assault rifles, and, you know, they came in like, that's it, everybody up against the wall. These are Catholics, Spanish, Portuguese Catholics, oh my gosh, they're doing Christianity, they're doing Catholicism here, let's lock them up. The problem was that these people, they didn't speak Dutch very well, and the Dutch didn't speak Portuguese very well, and they couldn't communicate with each other. And they were even more suspicious. Of course, these are Catholic. I mean, what else do they practice in Portuguese if not Catholicism? So they were like, you know, going to throw them out, you know, lock them up. So there was one person by the name of Vega, Emmanuel Rodriguez Vega, He eventually changed his name to Yaakov Tereda, but he was fluent in Latin. Oh, Latin was a language that you could find somebody who spoke Latin. So he spoke with them in Latin, and he convinced them. He said, look, we have a religion that's more persecuted than your religion. We're Jews. So we're not Catholics. We have nothing against, we just want Jews. And he tried to convince him. He says, you're probably better off allowing Jews to come here. If you'll see, allow Jews to come, it'll build up your country. And whatever he said must have convinced them, because they let them go. And that's where they, that was like, I guess, the start of, like, again, more of a open Jewish with the authorities, now that they had somebody to talk to. And they eventually opened up a kehila called Kahal Kehilas HaKodesh Beis Yaakov, after Yaakov Tereda. He was the first person. I guess he also now started having government political ties. They brought in a rabbi. The first rabbi they brought in was Yosef Pardo, who was in Venice at the time. And now the Amsterdam community started taking on Venetian customs. Okay? That's how it started. 1608, immigrants from North Africa started coming in. Remember, Palacio, the emissary from North Africa, so he brought some Jews over, and they also started coming, and they started a Kahal called Kahal Kedushas Neve Shalom. So now you had Kahal Kedushas Beis Yaakov and Neve Shalom. Their first rabbi was Rabbi Vega, and then Yitzhak Uziel Efez. Now, what's going to happen with Yitzhak Uziel? Okay, 1615, there's a famous jurist named Hugo de Grotius, and when he, sounds like he set up their entire political government laws and everything, and he was the one that gave first official recognition in 1650 to the Jewish community. So now they were officially sanctioned from the government that they were allowed to have their a Jewish congregation, a shul. They were allowed to have a Jewish community. Okay, the only thing is they had two requirements. First requirement is you can't marry a Christian. Okay. Okay. We could live with that. That's a good one. And the second one is that you are forbidden to have verbal attacks on Christianity from the pulpit.
Which that was good too.
It was also good. It makes sense. So, provided you could do those two things, we will give you official sanction. And so it was in 1615. It happened. Now, in 1619, Rabbi Yitzhak Uziel was very strict with his congregation. I didn't want to, from the way I understand it as follows, it went like this. The upper class in Portugal and Spain, the upper class would, in terms of, they would allow themselves to have, I guess to say it, they would have affairs, the men would have affairs with their slaves or whatever, their maids or whatever. It wasn't uncommon. But in Spain and Portugal, under the Christian religion, it was not so bad, because after you did it, you just went to your local Orthodox or unorthodox priest, and you just confessed, and that was it. That's it, you're good to go. Right? So before Rabbi Uziel came in, the other Vega and Prado, they understood this weakness of these people who were these Portuguese Balabatum, who felt that fell into that category, even though now that they're Jews. So they were trying to wean them off it and try to, in a slow in a easy way. But Rev Yitzhak Uziel, he was like, against this is usser, you can't do this. And when he became very strong against them, so they decided to open up a new community,
breakaway.
Which they did a breakaway, which is Kahal Kedushas Beis Yisrael. That's what they called it. So now you had three. So in 1619, around 1620, 1621, you had three different congregations, all among the Sephardim. And that was, also in around that year also, Moranos will expelled from France. Majority of them chose Amsterdam, and among them is the father of Baruch Spinoza, which I guess we'll get to in Mitzvah Shem next week. Hopefully we'll get to that a little bit. But what the Chiddush was, is Amsterdam, is that in 1638, all three congregations made up. And they all came with an agreement, and instead of having three different shuls in town, the shul I daven in and the other two, they all decided to come back as one big community, which is a big Chiddush. And so they sold off Kalkilas Yisrael, Beis Yaakov and Beis Yisrael, and they expanded Kahal Kedushas Neve Shalom. They expanded it. And that was in 1638. And that's it. So now you had one big Sparta community. In 1675, just to show you, I guess, how rich this community was, I'm guessing they had a few thousand Jews at the time, about 4,000 or 5,000. I don't know if the Sephardic community in this time ever numbered more than 4,000 or 5,000 people. But they built a new shul, took 4 years to build, at a cost of 186,000 florins. I have no idea what a florin is, but it seemed to have been a very, very exorbitant shul. It's around today. And it was very expensive at the time. The new shul sat 900 men, 400 women, supported by 12 pillars, and 12 being the 12 shvatim. Okay, but that was in 1675. And I think we go to the Ashkenazim. Okay, one other thing. In 1605, Portugal, the Portugal crown, I guess they needed money. So every time they need money, you could do something like this. You have like a general amnesty. And basically the king of Portugal said, all right, all those of you that are Muranos or doing bad things, you know what, just with a confession, we'll look the other way for about a year. So with a 2 million ducats bribe, they made it easier on the new Christians or the Murano community, and they got like a little bit of a breathing space. So the Portuguese Inquisition, was it around then? Yeah, for sure it was around then. So that's it. They just looked the other way for a year. There was actually about 410 prisoners, and they were released from prison, and they took advantage of the time, and most of those prisoners ran to Amsterdam. They were in prison probably because they got caught as Muranos. So while they were pardoned, so to speak, they just got out. Afterwards, after the year, the Portuguese Inquisition just took over where they left off. You know, they in 1630, the Inquisition probably became more intense. Also, people started coming to Amsterdam. By the end of the century, there were about 4,000 to 5,000 Portuguese Muranos or whatever, conversos, Ashkenazim. And now the Ashkenazim arrived in Amsterdam, refugees from the mainly from the Chmielnytsky uprising, which is, but even before that, the 30 Years' War. First public Ashkenazic service was in 1635. Their numbers soon swelled, eventually outnumbering the Sephardic Jews at the end of the century. By 1674, there's about 5,000 of them, while they had 2,500 Sephardim. At that point afterwards, it was always more Ashkenazim. Ashkenazim would be constantly coming, but the Ashkenazim were very, very poor. They were refugees. They were poor, whereas the Sephardim, they were the businessmen. They came with their money, and they were part of the community they built in. It was a lot more money was in the Sephardic community than the Ashkenazi community. I think I saw a number where like about if the general people below the poverty level in Amsterdam was about 15% of the population was poor, so about like 80% of the Jews that were there were poor. Of Ashkenazi Jews were poor. So it was a very poor community. They also ended up building, however, nevertheless, it didn't stop the Sephardic community to sponsor the Jews and help the Ashkenazim Jews as well. To the credit of the Sephardic community, they were very helpful and with the Jews as well. In 1671, the large Ashkenazi community, they had their own shul, a great synagogue, which stood opposite to the Sephardic synagogue. Soon other synagogues were built, the Obin Shul, the Trit Shul, and the Niji Shul. Okay, these are different shuls. I don't know how many of these shuls survived the Holocaust. I know one of them did. So you have, I think it was this, the first one, the Great Synagogue, the Sephardim. The Sephardic shul ended up becoming a landmark. Because it was a landmark, the Germans in World War II didn't touch it. They left it. But the Ashkenazic shul was not a landmark, so they turned that into like a stable or something, put animals in there. So the building, I think, survived, and it was, you know, redone after the war. Jews were an important part of the merchant person's great ability. Okay, I'm thinking that this is, now I'd like to, I guess maybe we're going to just next week, talk about the Jews, a few things. First, about the Jews in Dutch India Company, the West and East Dutch India Company, how they played a part in the companies and what happened afterwards. And talk about Menashe Ben Yisrael. Menashe Ben Yisrael, who was a Rav, and he was the one who was negotiating with Oliver Cromwell to try to get the Jews back into England. Okay, at the time, Oliver Cromwell was called the protectorate, get to it, and during a time while they deposed of the kings of England. So we'll talk about that. Also a little bit about Baruch Espinoza. And all right, that's, I guess we'll continue next week with that. Any questions? Yes.
What is the Stadtholder?
Oh, Stadtholder is just another name of a governor. Governor of of the province. They were called Stadtholders? Or is it Stadtholder? He was the governor. William of Orange was a Stadtholder of one of the provinces. Okay.